and welcome back to the Jane Q Public Podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Qureshi, also known as Q. Today's guest is a fascinating woman I've been watching online for several years. Shireen Quadosi is the founder at the Foundation for Human Belonging. She's lived as an immigrant on three continents and has spent more than a decade focused on migration, radicalization, and adaptation across seismic cultural shifts. Today, she works beyond polarity, and she's dedicated to developing a new model of conscious leadership rooted in the feminine. Welcome, Shireen.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Well, I mean, there is a lot to talk about, especially in that introduction, and even more that I have to ask you. But to start our conversation, I'm going to ask you an icebreaker question. Is that cool?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. What is the last book that you read?
Well, completely or like read something from?
Oh, no. Like, I'm a believer that you don't have to finish a book, right? Like, if you just like read it, then, or if it's something that you read ongoing or if it's something that you regularly reference, that's fine too.
Sure. Okay. So there's like seven books at any given point, but the last one that I've touched is The Magdalene Mysteries. It's called The Left-Handed Path of the Feminine Christ. And it touches on the sort of hidden sacred feminine lineage that we have as women and as faith keepers. And it's been sort of like the study that I'm doing on where did we lose the feminine within my own faith tradition, which is Islam, but also like where does that sort of come in with where we are in the 21st century, where we're having literally wars over, you know, what a gender is. But I think feel like when that larger conversation, we're completely forgetting like what is below the, what I call the identity marker of gender, and what does it mean to be in the feminine, and how does our faith tradition and our lost lineage speak to that and inform us in where we are today.
It kind of jives with the idea of like the yin and yang, right? That there is a natural masculine energy and feminine energy, and every person, regardless of their gender, embodies those elements. And some have, you know, different degrees of each, but both are naturally occurring, and both are extremely necessary. And the imbalance is where we see all kinds of, you know, bad shit going down. And I would definitely say that we've had a dominance of male energy for the last, 2,000 years.
I would add that even the idea of male energy, I feel like, you know, and this has been something I've arrived at from very personal touch points, like my father, who was that traditional alpha male, to my son, who was the complete opposite, that made me completely rethink the gender question and speak to the energies because he's not that traditional alpha male. And looking at where we are today, the systems we are in today, I feel like the men are also shortchanged because they've gotten what is essentially a very distorted idea of what is masculine, that 1950s, you know, alpha male Superman model, rather than look at the energetic currents that can also be within a healthy masculine, like magician, lover, warrior, and king, those archetypes. And I feel like for both of us, you know, we can't have that healthy yin and yang until we know of those dualities within and without and how to bring balance back into those dualities.
Super interesting. So I guess some of the work that you're doing at your foundation, in the introduction, I mentioned that you're talking that you're working on a model of conscious leadership rooted in the feminine. What does that mean?
That means quite a lot. So I'm going to backtrack a little. The last few years since 2019, officially 2020, I've just seen this, you know, in 2019, I anticipated that we're going to have increased radicalization because of this hyper focus on the surface level of identity. And in 2020, I think we all sort of collectively saw the outer and inner worlds burning apart, and you're left with what's left after everything all burns away. And part of that is the experiential process of when things are burning away. And so I took essentially the last 20 years of my life, and specifically the last 5 years of my professional life and my passion, which is extremism and understanding what's going on, and paired it with the bigger picture. So what is the bigger picture here? when I look at myself or I look at other women who have, who've really sort of, they've been bearing the brunt of the fallout from COVID with the emotional labor, the household responsibilities, the, you know, the sort of devastating impact on our careers, the fallout from the education system. And now we're, you know, educating our kids on our own and doing all of this. I feel like culture was so, and government institutions were so comfortable just kind of like putting all that on us. And we barely talked about it. And I said, how can I take the fact that my world is falling apart? My child's world has fallen apart. I've studied worlds falling apart for the last 20 years and bring together a model that looks at these different components, but through what I feel is my strength as a feminine leader. And I use that word very carefully because I'm not what I consider a feminine person per se, but it's the soft skills, understanding, compassion. You know, it started with something like the Isis brides. When we look at the Isis brides, which is even such a masculine way to talk about a woman in relation to her gender relationship in a marriage, you know, we're not even looking at the names of these people. We're looking at all these issues of, you know, not just what's happening now, but where's the world going to be when these kids grow up, when the children of this generation grow up? And I feel like what we need is compassion. We need patience. We need responsiveness, not reactivity. And I brought all that together under sort of, if you think of four circles, you think of one circle as polarization. You think of one circle as childhood, one as woman. And what does it mean to be in feminine leadership in the sense of bringing grace and balance? And we've seen that in the interfaith realm with the, I think it was the, I don't know if it was the Abraham Accords, but it was another one where it was a very innovative pathway towards interfaith, but it was rooted in a feminine practice. And we look at the fourth corner, which is interfaith. You look at all of those circles and you look at how all those circles touch each other. What you have is essentially a pathway back into remembrance. And this is where Indigenous wisdom comes in. This is where the refugee work comes in, you know, looking at refugees as stewards, not as people who've been dispossessed or need to be fit in somewhere, but as stewards, people who've literally been forced to shed their entire way of being and find new pathways. And I look at how can we look at all of these issues through a softer lens that isn't looking to fight anything, that isn't looking to shame anything, that isn't looking to demonize anything. And I use that experience as a mother because I have a son who is on the autism spectrum and his needs are quite advanced in the sense that he's extremely still vulnerable like a child. He's 11, but he's emotionally, capacity-wise, in a lot of functional ways, still like a 3 to 5 year old. And so it's forced me to really sort of saturate in what does it mean to be innocent? What does it mean to be loving? What does it mean to create space and listen? And I feel like that at its heart is the strengths that we have in feminine energy, whether it's, again, doesn't matter if you're male or female or whatever. I think we all have that capacity within us. How do we tap back into that to create solutions that are not rooted in going against the grain, but going with the grain? So an example I'll give, I did a talk yesterday on counterterrorism and women in extremism. And the angle there is when we're looking at, for example, women who've joined ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whoever, rather than shaming them through the lens of like female empowerment, which is a completely Western idea, look at how Islam, for example, gives a pathway to honoring the feminine in the language, in the word Allah, in the hadiths, in the sunnahs, in the scriptures. And then where in that did we miss sort of the conversation? And how can we resurrect the conversation to go deeper? Example I'll give is when we talk about, you know, a woman's place is quote unquote, like in the home or in the kitchen or whatever. What does that really mean? And what does that mean in Islamic sense? And in Islamic sense, that's the heart and the home. And if we were to broaden that conversation, what would that conversation look like if we were to expand the idea of home, heart, and belonging? So a really quick story I'll give is, you know, I went to, if I can give a story real quick.
Of course.
I went to Death Valley. Death Valley National Park has like these sand dunes, right? And I thought, oh, cool, sand dunes, like it'll be like the beach. It was nothing like the beach. Have you ever been?
I have not.
Oh, no. God. Okay, within 2 minutes, my feminism went out the window. It's awful. You go in and you sink into the sand and this hot sand is pouring around you like water and you're trying to climb. And I'm just like, oh God, I'm like, you can have my vote, whatever. I don't care. I'm not fighting in this. I'm not trading in this. I would rather be in the tent. And on the surface level, like if I were to go back in the sort of the cradle of Islamic civilization, if I was to go back, would I be content with giving up those rights? Yeah, of course, because I'm not going to go and fight those people in this. I can't even stand in this sand, let alone fight in it. But then it's not the end of the conversation. The conversation then extends to, well, what does that mean? If I know my capacity is not out there, but it's within the home, within the tent, so to speak, with the children, what does that capacity look like? How can we broaden that beyond just, oh, I'm someone's wife or mother or, you know, whatever, but how do we expand that inner landscape of how I can contribute to the outer landscape?
I had a really nice connection with a woman who runs a series of girls' schools in Afghanistan. Do you know Dr. Sakina Yakubi?
No.
Do you know of her? Okay, she's really cool. And her whole take on it, she was there on the ground. Like, she lived there. She is Afghan, right? Her position was, she was able to start these schools under the Taliban because she was able to use Islam, right? And when Westerners went in there and were trying to provide secular solutions, it didn't work. It was considered very threatening. And which is, all, you know, as an aside, it's the reason why we need to let people on the ground where they are do the work and fund it rather than trying to go in and save them. But it also speaks to what you're saying, which is there's a cultural consciousness that exists within each culture on earth and each microculture. And the people that are actively engaged in that, the people that are born and raised into that, the people that are very familiar with it, are the ones that must do the work to change it. And it has to be done using the same frameworks that they, you know, that everyone agrees on and that everybody understands. And this idea that we're going to, you know, somehow, you know, take some random ideas or theories or philosophies and throw them over the top of another group of people or another culture and say, this is going to work for you. It's the same reason, you know, it's like democracy. Americans mm-hmm. love democracy. And so we go and we like take democracy to people and we make them do it. And then it always gets messed up because it didn't come from the people, right? They're the ones, if they see the value in it, they're the ones that have to fight for it. They're the ones that have to develop the desire for it. They're the ones that have to, and there are activists within these different cultures who are very passionately working on those, you know, on those things. And you can help by making sure they get what they need. But like, you're not going to turn Iraq or Afghanistan or any place into an American style democracy. It's just not going to work.
No, absolutely not. And I'll add the African proverb that says, the eye that leaves the village sees further or farther. And I think that speaks to the work that, you know, the thing that I find fascinating about what you do and who you are as a person is you've got this really like complex background and you've left it. You've picked up some other tools and some other practices. You've discovered, more importantly, who you are as an inner sort of spirit. And then you've come back. So if you come back, like same way that I did, right? I left the swamp, you can say, of the nonprofit Islamism politicized sector and left it, figured out all these other things, figured out who I was, and then you come back with something so much more crafted and enriched. And so, you know, I feel like how can we leverage more of those experiences, which is the same thing I say about refugees, right? Instead of banning people, it's how can you activate people? How can you work within the cycles that they're going to experience and help them process that? But how can you also give them the ability to activate those experiences if that's what they choose?
Right. That's the key, right? So let me ask you this about just feminism in general, because I feel like, you know, I've followed you for a long time, and I think that you have a really unique take on feminism. I consider you a feminist, but then you're also very, you know, some of the issues that you, where you stand, I don't agree with you. And so I feel like that's a really interesting, I want to know, well, I guess to put it simply, do you think there's more than one way to be a feminist?
It's a really interesting question. I'm glad you brought it up because I don't think I would call myself, I mean, maybe I have in the past, I don't remember vividly if I ever did, but I don't think that's one of those words I ever really found home with. And even now, as my views, some of my new views contradict my earlier views, and some of my new views expand on those earlier views, I feel like ultimately for me, rather than the label or the lack of a label, what I would say is, you know, can we, even around the conversations on gender and abortion and all these really pivotal, passionate issues that are coming up, my orientation is, why can't we educate women or expose them to the full spectrum of the conversation and then trust them to decide whatever it is they want to do, whether it is, you know, pro-feminist, anti-feminist, I don't care, like whatever it is. Let's talk about abortion real quick. You want to have an abortion, like that's fine. But do you know, have you been exposed to the full conversation on quote unquote, like both sides, so to speak, before you're making that decision? And if you have, then great. And if you haven't, then like, why aren't we exposing women? And an example I'll give is, you know, I've had life experiences where you go through and you get married and you have a kid and you go through all the things you're supposed to go through. And this is like one of those hidden things that we just don't talk about. Like it's the, we talk about it, but we never openly talk about it as women, which is when my marriage was going down, like, you know, basically like the crapshoot, which was basically 3 months in. And, but 5 months later, we got a divorce. I'm sorry, 5 years later, we got a divorce. It was when I started talking to other women, we were all experiencing the same thing. No one just talked about it. No one talked about what changes when you have a kid, what changes for you as a woman when you have a child, what changes when you have a marriage, how culture informs those things, how interfaith informs those things. There was just no dialogue whatsoever. And I think, you know, going back, hindsight being 2020, like, let's just assume that I would still be who I am today because I wouldn't change that for anything. But if I could go back and change a few things without it impacting, you know, where I am today, yeah, 100%. Like, that would be amazing. And I feel like when it comes to feminism, it's like we still, you know, whether it's, you know, one political space or another, or cultural or religious, I feel like we're still forcing women into a box rather than just being like, hey, I love and trust you enough for you to make the decision that's right for you. And if later on you decide it's not the right decision and you made the wrong decision, I will still be here for you. But I love you enough to give you everything you might want to know, and you do with it what you want. And if you have questions, we'll do our best to help you. But it's what's missing in the media. It's what's missing in the political conversations. It's what's missing in our national dialogue, this ability to just trust each other.
And you said, you know, earlier when you just, you know, your explanation, you said, you know, listening to both sides. And actually, I don't think there are two sides. I think there are as many sides as there are people. And the sheer diversity of religious, political, and philosophical thought that exists in reality is absolutely demolished in public conversation and in media. You're right. Even people that I know personally, I see them, you know, engaging online around certain things, and they're much more polar in the way that they position themselves. Whereas the conversations that I have with people, private conversations, you get a bunch of ladies together in a room with a pot of tea, and we're talking about things in completely different terms and with so much nuance. And at the same time, nobody's threatened by that. Like, I can sit there in a room with five or six women, drink tea, and, you know, we can have conversations where we're disagreeing or we have our own positions, and nobody feels like, oh my God, this person's going to try and, you know, force me to do that or whatever. And so I think one of the things that concerns me, you know, and this podcast really is about how technology is impacting things in the world, and especially our society. I think one of the things that is deeply concerning is that we're being sort of indoctrinated into this idea that there are only two ways of seeing things, and one of them has to be right and one of them has to be wrong. And that is simply not true. And it has never been true. I mean, it's just not. There are infinite ways to approach life, and there are infinite ways to be right and infinite ways to be wrong. And if we are going to box ourselves in and force ourselves into these dogmatic little corners, none of us are going to end up, we're all going down. That's the bottom line, because we're simply not governing, self-governing according to reality.
I love that line, self-governing according to reality. And I feel like the reality is in real time, real relationships, real spaces, rather than just the avatar and the illusion of warmth that we give ourselves in our online space. And so one of the examples I'd love to share in reference to this idea of, you know, there's only like one side or one right way, or this pressure to just pick a side, you know, which is echoed in every part of life, I think, right now on the surface level, is the Genesis story, the origin story, the Garden of Eden story in the Bible, which obviously is in the other faith traditions as well, Judaism and Islam. It's when they talk about the tree that you're not supposed to eat from, the tree of forbidden fruit, it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's not the tree of good and evil. It's tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I think that's so important, Amanda, because it's awareness of this idea, this fictional idea of polarity, of black and white, good and evil. It never says that this actually exists. It's acceptance of this idea. So when you eat the apple, you're ingesting this idea and you're distorting your own being with this idea that is rooted in distortion, which is separation, which is good and evil.
See, this is my lingo, because I, as you know, am into Zen. And that's really like a foundational concept in Zen, is that there isn't this binary that we live by. And that our attachment to those binaries is really the root of all our suffering. And I think that you're right on there. And what's so interesting as you're talking is that I realize how much of that is baked in to all of these traditions. It's just been ignored, basically. Like, people just, they don't care that that's, you know, that's part of it. They want to believe, and their cognitive biases are going to root through the texts and find whatever gives them their comfort in trying to dominate with what they think is right.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so important to leave that proverbial village and find oneself. One of the most special sort of medieval text, I can't remember the name, I'm awful with the names of things, but it's a medieval text, and it's about this guy who is, it's a story about a guy who basically like is isolated on an island for I think like 17 years or something. Mm-hmm. And in that time, he learns everything he needs to learn. He learns about the animals. He learns about himself, the things that really matter, right? Like, if you're in the oasis of like your own inner sanctuary, as free from outside influence. And it's when he goes outside and back into the normal world is when he loses that. And he realizes the disassociation between the divine realm, which is, you know, the Garden of Eden or the inner sanctuary or the inner landscape, and then the outer. And it's what we lose when we forget that at our heart, we are all holy beings, that we have within us all we need. But it's when we become attached to, you know, the binary, we become attached to this very small little identity of Muslim or Christian or Jew, that we kind of forget that the picture of who we are is so much bigger than we could ever imagine.
Yeah. So I want to use that as sort of a jumping off point, because a lot of what you are talking about, especially with regard to, you know, your concept of femininity and feminine leadership and the softness with which you're trying to address these issues, is truly counterculture. It is a countercultural thing, because it feels to me, you know, and again, this is just my observation, but it feels to me like there is a very strong pull toward judgment and punitive measures in our society and in the way that we address conflict, which is, you know, natural. I think conflict is great. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I'm not trying to ever get rid of conflict, but the way that we address it has to be healthy and productive. And it's not. What I'm seeing is a very strident kind of way of addressing other people and the differences that are, again, reality. And I find that incredibly scary, because to me, that's when you start to lose your humanity, is when you become so much more invested in a philosophy or an idea than you are in relationships with the people around you. And then you start to ignore everyone except the people that agree with you. And then it becomes very, very easy to dichotomize and fight. And fight in ugly ways, in ways that are not productive and healthy. And so I'm curious to know, you know, do you find, you know, like, even this idea of like, you had put something in your bio about you shed your skin, right, of your identity markers. by choosing to no longer self-identify based on race, ethnicity, faith, or political ideologies. That is anathema to the culture that we live in right now, right? So how do you feel, well, first of all, how successful have you been in getting people to respond to your message and the way that you are expressing it?
Well, we're going to find out, because I just recently became, I think in the last couple of weeks actually, became more open to being vocal about this and sharing this pathway. So on a personal note, I took a position for the last year that would allow me to save up enough so that when I was ready to fully launch this vision and this calling and this becoming, it would be without any political strings to any other organization or party. Because even in a non-political organization, there's pressure to sort of drink the Kool-Aid and to curtail what you say in public. And so as of the last month, I left my full-time position and I'm fully launching myself. I'm working on the foundation's website. I'm doing a couple talks and really organizing and presenting this to the public and then pushing for the presence, which is the part of all this I hate. And so if anyone has any help that they'd like to offer in that regard with connections, I'll be more than happy to take it. But it's what I found with the tests that I've done in the past, right, where I've started writing differently in the last couple of years. I've started sharing differently. I've started presenting myself differently and more in alignment with who I feel I really am. And what I find in that is there is such a receptivity, particularly among men, which I find fascinating. Because typically in the space that I came in, or came from, which was that counter-Islamist circuit, most of my followers were men because it's a very masculine subject matter. But what I found is that they were very, very open to talking about things differently, to the softer sort of way of speaking. Now, they may not always agree with everything, but they're curious about it. And I think that speaks to something that's within themselves, the onslaught that they may be feeling as men in their personal lives or in culture, in the way that, you know, men are shamed. For example, like I have a son, and when I hear the phrase futurist female, I worry for him. Is there going to be place for him in the future just because he has a different gender anatomy? So I find men really receptive. I find women to be more curious. And so I'm kind of moving in slightly different circles. Women in the counter-Islamist circuit pretty much don't, except for the a few editors here and there. They largely don't really fall for it in the sense that they are still, that language, the rhetoric there is still focused on women's empowerment, which doesn't fucking mean anything. Can I cuss?
Yeah, of course.
It doesn't mean anything. Like, you know, I see these things about, oh, let's empower women, women's rights. But like, I feel like I've heard that drumbeat for so long. No disrespect to anybody, but I feel like I've heard that drumbeat for so long. Like, how else can we talk about this? What else does it mean? Because at this point, a lot of the interfaith work, a lot of the women's empowerment work, it's kind of just a different color on the same compost, so to speak. It's just the same shit. It's just colored a different way.
Yeah.
And I don't think it moves the needle. And I think it actually disempowers women because we act like we're some sort of victimized class that needs to, you know, needs a special celebration day or it needs a special victory banner. And I feel like that doesn't do us any favors. So what I find among women is a subtle curiosity, especially within the sort of spiritual community. But I think there is something here, Amanda. I think, you know, I'm so grateful that for whatever it took 20 years essentially to be on this journey to arrive at that sort of nexus point that I'm at today. And what I'm finding is that I'm not crazy because people like you exist. People who are like-minded in other areas, when I speak to autism or when I speak to education, there are people who are like-minded. And it's just a matter of how do you articulate all the different sort of bits of chaos that are out there and the noise that's out there and synthesize it into a message that is so cohesive. And that's the heart of what I'm working on passionately, almost like 4 or 5 hours every day is my book, The Song of the Human Heart, which takes all of this chaos and this noise and humanizes it in a way that creates a conversation that offers dignity to these subjects and to the people who embody these subjects.
Yeah, and that's very aligned to the work that I do, as you know, at IDCC, which is I'm trying to humanize the web. It's not about creating influencers or trying to, you know, game the algorithms and all of that crap. That's marketing. What I'm talking about here is what's the potential for our technology to truly leverage our humanity, right? And to me, that's like, that's always been the promise of the web. How do we find the right people, no matter who you are or where you're from or how much money you have or whatever, anywhere on the planet, who gets super excited about the same stuff you do and wants to build something awesome, right? And it just, I'm so frustrated that what has come from it is what we see today, which is just a shit show. How do you feel that technology, and particularly the web and social media, has impacted the conversation that you're trying to, I don't want to say lead, but that you're trying to
facilitate.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? I think, to go back to the granular, I had to sort of leave Twitter a little bit because I lost, let's say 20,000 followers when I started being more nuanced. Mm. And I had to stay a little bit from Facebook because Facebook still was very combative. And I went to Instagram and I felt Instagram was a better platform. And I just kind of started from scratch on Instagram. And Instagram for me worked better because it was more visually oriented. So you can have a visual language there that you can never have on Twitter, that you can't, doesn't really have space for on Facebook. So that visual language, it, yes, it helped me connect with others and there's a slow growing community there, but it also helped me organize my thoughts internally better because I started seeing patterns where patterns would come up. I started using it as an inspiration board and an ideation board. And I was able to better organize who I wanted to be in the sort of digital space of like a creatrix, so to speak, which is what Instagram was for me. But in terms of, in terms of the larger conversation, it is challenging. It's disheartening. When you can get caught up in that narrative of, oh, look, so-and-so had so many hits or so many likes and here you are with zero or here you are with like five. But at the heart of it, Amanda, it comes back to a dream. The reason I started this entire work, so to speak, 20 years ago is because I started having a series of dreams that made no sense. And it's one of the reasons I left law school to go into the rabbit hole of theology was one of the dreams I had was I was in a race and I hate running. Like I'm terrible at it too. Like I sound like I'm dying. So I'm in a race, which is already a nightmare to begin with. And everyone's kind of following the same pathway and someone comes up from like behind these glass doors and says, hey, come here. This is a shortcut. Well, I love shortcuts and races. I hate, I cheated in PE all my entire life. Yes, I will follow you through these, ominous glass doors. And the glass doors leads to another set of glass doors. And that second set of glass doors leads to like a cliff overlooking like some sort of a cavern or desert or whatever. And the person said, just start speaking. And I'm like, what do you mean, just start speaking? And this is before I even practiced public speaking or engaged in any of that. And they said, just start speaking. And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, just say what's on, whatever they said. And I said, but there's nobody there. Who am I speaking to? And the dream pivoted then to the perspective of the people on the ground looking up at me, all the people I could never see and would never see who were listening. This could be symbolic of ancestors. This could be symbolic of, people who follow my work, who I don't know. I mean, this could be what is promised to come down the road. We don't know. There's been other moments where I was at the Lincoln Memorial, and this was like 2012. Again, before I heavily invested in the sort of mystical aspect of this work. And I'm at the Lincoln Memorial and I'm standing, it's the first time I've been there, I'm standing in the steps of where Martin Luther King was when he gave that speech, I Have a Dream. And I stand there and I have this really visceral experience that I cannot describe, that I can, at least I couldn't then. And I had this emotion, just this wave of emotion come over me. And I tried my damnedest to not cry, to not break down in tears, because I could just feel it, my throat, my eyes, I could just feel this welling of tears and this emotion of in part, it felt like the veil had lifted between the emotion of the time that was and the time that is to come still, and this meeting point, which is where I was at that point. And I look around and I see a bunch of Black kids, and this is speaking from a place of true naivety and innocence, right? I see a bunch of Black kids who were there and none of them had this emotional reaction. And I'm like, shouldn't they feel this? Like, this is more closer to their experience genetically and ancestrally. And they didn't. And I thought something was wrong with me. And at that time, my husband at the time was like, who knew that I didn't really cry, didn't really express emotion openly. He's like, are you okay? I can see you're like holding it together by a hair. And, you know, the fact that he noticed it was a big deal too, because he typically didn't notice anything. So, I mean, this was clearly like a moment. And in the last year, I've had more and more of those moments where this veil between the inner being, the highest self, and what is still out there, what is calling to you, what is beckoning you, which a lot of times you don't even really can't put into words, right? There is a separation there. Like there is the separation of the veil. The veil lifts and I feel this emotion. And I know that whether I have like 5 followers or 10,000, it doesn't matter. That this has to be said, how it impacts who, whether it becomes anything, it's besides the point. That this is essentially what we're here for at this point in human history.
You know, I always tell people, you're using the wrong metrics to measure your success, right? If you're trying to get 1 million followers, if you're using the same metrics as the New York Times or Kim Kardashian, you are using the wrong metrics, because that's not what the internet is good for. To me, that's maybe not the worst, but the least valuable way that you can use the internet. You know, what I was talking about before is about depth, not breadth. Mm. It's about getting the right people together as opposed to 1 million people that could really not give a shit in the end, right? They're not going to do anything. They're not really going to get invested in it. They don't really care what you have to say. You are at best a mild amusement for them, mm-hmm. right? And for me, this is sort of a countercultural point of view. I would rather have, you know, 1,000 solid, well-placed followers than, you know, 10 million jackasses who just don't even really pay attention to anything. They're just out there, you know, whatever. To me, that's not the goal here. To impact the world, you have to connect in a very human way with other people. Relationships are everything. And you simply are not building relationships. There's no possible way to build relationships with that many people. It's just not even socially possible. So, you know, I mean, it's nice. I mean, it's vanity to say I have, you know, 10 million people following me. But how many of those people are ready to jump on your bandwagon and ride it all the way to the end? And that to me is the important part. How many people do you really feel a connection with? Do you listen to and respond to in a back and forth that enriches you both? And to me, that's the goal. And that's especially a goal for somebody who's trying to infuse these ideas that are so valuable and so important into the world. Because again, those people will go out and they'll do the work with what you've given them, right? With your relationship will impact them in such a way that they will go out and do things that impacts the whole world. So yeah, I mean, I also get what you're saying, because I feel the same way about sort of this detachment. Again, this is a very Zen thing, this idea of being detached from outcomes. You do what you're meant to do because you are meant to do it, not because you're trying to get something out of it, right? And if something happens along the way, awesome, but that's not why you're doing it. You're doing it because that's what you're supposed to be doing. That's your calling. You know, if there is such a thing as a calling, that's what it is. And I'm never happier than when I'm doing exactly the thing that resonates in that way with me. And like same with you. Like there's plenty of people that have no interest, zero interest in what I have to say. And that's okay. It's okay. I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for me, and I'm putting it out there to see if anyone else is into it. And some people are. Not millions, but that's okay.
I think that's what resonates with people about you. You know, when we're on, like, for example, on Facebook, when we're on Facebook and it's this scrolling of like whatever, nonsense that doesn't matter whatsoever. And then you have this spark of joy that comes from Amanda. And it's just, you know, it's human, it's relational. You're asking about people. It's like the equivalent of asking someone how their day was and genuinely being interested in the answer. And it's that simple sort of practice that I think goes back to the humanizing technology bit That goes back to like building relationships, that goes back to just doing what comes from your heart. For example, the book that I'm writing now is probably the product of something that happened 20 years ago. 20 years ago when I, in my, what was it, late 2000s, I wrote a book, got an agent. The book went into a bidding war with three publishers, dream scenario, right? And all three publishers wanted me to write more about the woe is me Muslim woman story, which was so popular back then. Right. And I was in my early 20s and I knew fuck all about life. Like I knew I was smart enough to know I was stupid. So that was one thing. And then the second thing is I didn't want to write that book. It wasn't supposed to be about me. Now, 20 years later, I come back and I took the advice of a colleague who passed away, Eugene Kane, who was at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And when I first kind of got into the public space, he told me, you got to start talking about yourself. You have to start becoming comfortable. It took me another 15 years to understand how to do that organically without feeling like I was just making it about me. But I threw that book away and I said, this isn't right. The foundation is something that people told me to start doing in 2015-16. They told me you need to have your own organization. It needs to be focused on. These are women, powerful women who are in positions of leadership, who I shall not name, said, you need to do your own thing. Make it about women's rights because that's always so popular. That will get you funding. Everyone loves women's rights. They couldn't give a fuck about women's rights, but it was just something that sold. Or you got to do your own thing, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And yeah, sure, I can. I can talk about women's rights all day, every day. But unless there is an authenticity and an original message, which took me another 5 years to come up with and synthesize, I just feel like, what is our purpose here? Are we here to sit there and do what every other fucking person before us came here to do and do it in exactly the same way? And I think like one of the biggest breaks in that systematic pattern thinking was my autistic child, who I literally had to become a different person for, the best version of myself. And even then I'm working on it every day because no one's perfect. I had to become a radically different person for him. And I thought, okay, if I can do it for him, I can do it for anything else. I can do it for the work. I can do it for myself. I can take the practice of what I'm experiencing with him, because clearly I can do it. And then apply that authenticity and apply his authenticity that he inspires me to live towards the other areas of life so that you're not just, you know, becoming just another cog in the machine. Even if you aren't per se a cog in the machine, you can be influential. You can have $1 million. But unless what you've come up with, the ideation, hasn't broken the pattern that's destructive and destroying us, leaving us alive, to me, it's just a fucking waste of time.
I think that's right, actually. I would rather spend my time as a hermit or with a handful of people, you know, than go out there and produce something that I'll put it this way. I realized at a certain point, a few years ago, that a lot of people were following me on the internet or claiming friendship with me online because they liked how I made them feel about themselves. And that goes back to I was writing the story of my my religious life, and I would get people who just it was affirming to them that I was, you know, on their team or whatever. And I don't want that. I want people to engage with me in a relational way because they see value in me, even when they don't agree, or even if I do challenge things about them. And that's not a thing that people want. It's not a thing that people want from the internet, I guess. I don't know. But like, it's a very natural thing. I have close friends in real life, have these complex and beautiful and multifaceted relationships with, where we're not all, you know, blowing smoke up each other's asses. And I don't want that online either. I just don't. And I, you know, if that's all I accomplish is living my life in that way, where I'm truly having relationships with good people and being a good friend and a good mother and a good wife, then I'm good. I'm good.
I couldn't agree more. I think it goes back to the point that you made in the beginning, which is the unbecoming, the undoing, you know, the dissolving into sort of like, what is it when everything is taken away from you? One of most powerful questions I was asked in this journey the past few years was by a friend who asked me, who would you be if the stuff that you're doing was gone? And I didn't have an answer for it then, but it sat with me. And I feel like the deeper transformative changes in the work that anyone does comes in the metrics, you know, in the stuff that can't be they can't be calculated in metrics. You know, I've had experiences where I've had a conversation with someone, they didn't understand why I was doing anything that I was doing, and then 10 years later they came back with a different view and they asked questions. Or I've had, you know, when I went through questioning Islam in the early 2000s, it was awful, Amanda. I got kicked out of the home. I had to file restraining orders against family. Oh, sure. I was homeless for a while. Like, economically, financially, shattered me. It took me 10 years to even begin to recover from that. It was pretty bad. And 15 years later, the most volatile people in that family were having a calm conversation on atheism with my then atheist cousin. And I'm just looking at it and I'm like, wow, this wasn't possible 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
That's right. You know how I know when I'm doing what I need to do is when I'm not afraid. Like, even if I know other people will dislike it, I look back on it. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. I'll record a podcast or I'll write a piece and I'm like, you know, you get that kind of anxiety before you put it out there. Like, I know people are going to take issue with this or this. And then you kind of go back through and you're like, but is it true? Is this what I really think? And it is. And then I'm like, well, then fuck them.
Yeah.
Like, and if I can resolve myself to that point. And I spent so many years being so anxious and terrified because I didn't really believe the shit I was out there putting into the world. And now that's my litmus test for myself is, do I really think this? Am I afraid of it? Am I really afraid of other people's opinions on this? Nah, then I'm good. Right. And that's how I know I'm in my right, in the zone, because you can't trust other people's opinions. They have no idea. And this idea that we have to have other people telling us what's right and wrong and blah, blah, blah. This idea that we shouldn't trust ourselves, that we don't know intuitively and inherently what is best for us, to me is a ploy to remove your personal power.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And I would add that if you are, I wouldn't say looking to create something new, but if you're on a pathway where you feel something new being birthed, right, you will not have anyone else. Like, there will not be anyone else. Like, there is no one else I can go to and say, these are the four things I'm working on. This is the big circle I'm encompassing all four things in. What do you think? If they're not going to have a clue what I'm talking about, it's up to me to figure out, okay, how do I take all this and make it make sense? There are people who will be checkpoints or guides or bumpers or conversation partners for some of the touch points, right, along what you're creating. But ultimately, if you are being authentically true to yourself, you are bringing in some capacity, whether it's global, whether it's within your own personal life, whether it's something no one will ever see, you are bringing something entirely new. You will not have somebody else to counter that. So you can't rely on somebody else's opinion, because like you said, they're not going to know what you're talking about.
There's a lot to be said about getting comfortable with the discomfort of not having approval and of walking alone. Did you ever read the book Braving the Wilderness? It was a Brené Brown book.
Yeah, I think I did. I think I have it. Yes, I do. Yes.
I like her and I'm not a huge fan, but that book really hit me because I have spent so much time alone. And I also spent a good amount of time trying to avoid being alone like hell. And that ended me up in really bad situations. So for me, that idea that we belong exactly to ourselves and in our bodies and where we are, and other people's opinions on that matter not. And they won't. If you're really doing something, like you said, if you're really doing something new and interesting and outside the box, then you're not going to have a ton of support. Which brings me to this question, because I've struggled, you know, I've really struggled with IDCC, because to me, it's very clear. This is a necessary thing, right? We need this kind of training. We need this kind of understanding. We need this kind of dialogue around how digital media and how our engagement online is impacting our society. And, you know, it's just, yeah, some of the people are like, yeah, this is like the people who get it are like, this is amazing. We definitely need this. But they're a very small handful of people. And trying to convince all these other people, right, just for the sake of building and, you know, building the work and the community, I felt like a failure. I felt like I'm not getting anything across and people don't appreciate this for what it is. And I don't mean that in an egotistical way. I mean the value that I have, that I'm offering, is so much more than what I think people want. And it's incredible, like it's an incredibly frustrating position to be in. So do you think it's possible to be successful at scale with something that is relatively hard to grasp and new, that most people are just not convinced is necessary yet?
I think the key word is yet. And I did that program, right? So I can speak from experience that it was really valuable. And one of the things I still speak to and take away is for example, the 7 different like values people have, and people are usually fighting over a value. And that was so like, if that alone, that lesson alone was worth the whole course for me, because it helped me put into perspective so much of what I saw thereafter in the online sort of communities. I think the question that you're asking is so powerful, and it's such an important thing to hold with us, right? Because there's so many other people out there, I can only imagine, who are like-minded, who are trying to do something different, and the space isn't there yet. And I'll go back to like the 2000 elections, and we had, what was her name? The one who was running for office, who had no chance at that point. You know who I'm talking about?
Maybe. I don't remember.
Gosh, she's the one who's super spiritual and he did the Course in Miracles.
Oh, yeah, Marianne Williamson.
Yes, okay. So she ran, right? And I had some people saying, oh, she's never going to win. People who are like-minded saying she's never going to win. And I said, I know, but it doesn't matter. Because she brought to the national stage a conversation that had, at that point, never been at the national stage like that. She brought forward the language of compassion, the language of mercy. And so it introduced a new level of consciousness to people, a new level of normalization. What we're seeing since the years after that is so much more of a rift that, you know, it gets to the point where it gets so bad, like we hit rock bottom as a collective, that there is no way but up. There's no way but to look for something else. I have a friend of mine who's a dear colleague, who's creating this amazing program on human dignity, and it needs to be everywhere like 10 years ago. And we're struggling with, you know, securing like the last bit of financing for that. And it's fine, because we know that when society gets to the point where it really does need that tool, that sort of development, it will be ready for it. The time will be right. In the same way that, you know, the things that I speak to, the softer sort of lens, I couldn't have been that person 5 years ago, and the world couldn't have been accommodating to that. So I'll give you a really quick example is Salman Rushdie's attack, right? I'm writing 2 op-ed pieces on it that are not reactive, but responsive, not looking at, oh, free speech, or, oh, he got attacked, or, oh, Islamist. But the conversation goes deeper into how was the satanic versus a Pandora's box of the feminine, and how is the symbolic of the larger sort of, you know, war on language, so to speak. Both of those are not talking about Salman Rushdie. They're not talking about, you know, the Iranian regime or whatever. Like, I couldn't care less about that. Like, Godspeed to both of them. I'm talking about the bigger issue here. And I wrote to an old editor who writes for a publication, or who hosts a publication, who's very right-wingy, like extremely right-wingy. And I gave him my pitch, and he loved it. And he says, anything you want to write, we will publish. We will not like change it. Because, you know, there was that issue of like people change the titles, they change the papers, and it's a whole different article then. He goes, we will not change it. Why? Because a few years ago, I wrote a piece that was sympathetic to the value that people who are quote unquote like enemies or villains offer? Like, what did I still learn from the person who insulted my character? You know, literally in real life, the Robert Spencer is an example. Mm-hmm. He insulted my character. He launched a campaign, you know, and that's fine. But what was the value he still offered in that? And if you can go beyond the personal wounding or the personal victimization narrative of, oh, this person was mean to me, or this person doesn't believe what I said. It doesn't matter if he believes what I said. This is the value he still offered me, and I'm grateful for it. And I don't have to agree with him, and I don't have to like him, but there is a humanness to the story that we're telling. And this editor was extremely responsive to that. Now, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, I could have never gotten away with writing something like that on a platform that was so right-wingy. Things are changing. I think things are changing very slowly. I think that will speed up as things sort of break down even more. So I would say to the folks who are visionaries, because I feel you are, and I would have to be honest, and I think what I'm creating is also visionary. People who are visionary are going to have that sort of faith in the long game here. In the same way that, you know, when we look at the extremist circuits, they have faith in the long game as well. All Islamists have to do is wait for the U.S. to fall apart. All the right wing, you know, neo-Nazis have to do, same thing. They're just waiting. They're playing the long game. And I think people who try to do good, so to speak, who try to create a better world, we have a problem with patience. We have a problem with, like, we want the result right away. We want that award right away. And it just doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I feel convicted. No, it's so true. It's so true. Like, yeah, 100%. And it is intention, right? Like, this is the part that I'm just really grappling with as a 48-year-old is, yes, I should be, I need to be detached from the outcomes, but also I feel like I have a motivation to do something because that's simply my work. That's my calling. And so how do you live with that tension? How do you balance it so that you are able to actually do productive things and put them out into the world, but also not hinge your self-esteem and your happiness and your feeling of success on it? And that's really the key, in my opinion, because you're right. And I think if you can stick it out for a long time, if you can play the long game, eventually you're going to win, right? It's what the Taliban always say or have said about the U.S. You know, you guys have the watch, but we have the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this question of balance, like, what is balance?
I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. No, what was the question specifically? It was something to do with balance and how do you...
It wasn't a question as much as just I was just sort of expressing my emotional challenge, which is, you know, wanting very much to make a contribution and having a really strong and really clear vision, right? It's compelling. You want to act on it. You want to do something, but also you don't get to choose the outcome. You offer what you have to the world and you do it in the best way that you can. But there's a million people out there that have tried to put something good into the world. And
yeah, and you mentioned productivity too. And I think it's probably one of the most important questions, because we are in a culture of everyone needs to have like done a TED talk by 9, right? And we're in a culture where everyone wants to be an activist and everyone, you know, and it's, and so to that, I again point to my son, who's been such an anchor in the divine sort of state of being, because he's, I mean, that's a whole different conversation, but he's such a soulful, soulful person that he's protected me in so many ways against that sort of pattern of obsessive productivity, or because I just cannot. My own health is part of the reasons why I just cannot. So there's been things in my life where I've been forced to sort of just become slower. But what I've also learned in the last, I would say, couple of years since my 40th birthday, 40? Yeah, 40th birthday. I'll be 42 next month. So 40th birthday, I had a experience where I basically channeled, right? I don't know if you're familiar with that. And so it was, and it was around a dinner table with my very conservative, like, mother, you know, people I like and people I don't like. It was a very mixed bag. Like, if you were going to get the most brutal critics around, that would have been the night to do it, right? And so I had these very brutal critics around at a time where I was tapped into my into this intuition that I didn't even know I had. And that was an immersive moment that for me got me in the sort of, you know, over the next few months, begin trusting my intuition. Something that has always been there since childhood that I just got really good at ignoring when I had to be conditioned into different environments, moving to Europe and moving to the US as an immigrant, which was tougher than moving to Europe. And I just kind of forgot that. And it really sort of kindled that entire possibility of what is out there. And it made me so curious of like, well, what else is out there? Like, what else is out there that I didn't know was even possible? Like, it completely alters the frame of the width of frame that you see the world in. And the thing that I learned in that time over the last couple of years is, and it's gotten stronger and stronger, Amanda, to the point where like, it's with me every day, right? And it's a conversation I have with myself every day. And I know that when I follow my intuition, it's a 100% success, whatever it is. If I don't follow it, I will pay the price. And so, you know, and so learning to trust that sort of inner compass, which I think if we can cultivate that in people, because everyone has it, you know, no one is more exceptional than another person. It's just who has had the chance to embody some of those practices and become familiar with a self that we've forgotten. I think we forget that self in childhood. And when you practice the intuition, when you trust your intuition, it just goes easier. It's more graceful. You have a partner in yourself than when you are going with the time of what the dominant system says, which is the 9-to-5 schedule, which actually doesn't even work for women. Women go off of a 4-week cycle. We don't go off of a 9-to-5 cycle, which was designed for men. You know, you trust the rhythm and the pattern that comes with who you are. And it's a contradiction to the pattern that we've been told, like, oh, you need to hit 3 posts a week. You need to have your newsletter. You know, it just doesn't work like that. And so when we come back into remembering like sacred time, so to speak, and trusting our intuition, it becomes a much more graceful process. You're not in competition with some outside, you know, world. When the outside world, if you are in the field that we're in, the outside world cannot inform you. It cannot give you what you need. It can only give you the material that you can work with, but it is not a compass whatsoever.
That's why Braving the Wilderness was so great, is that it was an affirmation. And ever since I read that book, I actually have noticed other people who are kind of that way, who've chosen that path, that kind of unconventional path, or this visionary path, and who are so who are committed to it and who embrace sort of that loneliness, that wandering in the wilderness kind of situation. And while you are alone, while nobody's ever going to truly understand who you are and why you're, you know, what your motivations are for doing certain things, you can build a really great sort of network of people who understand what path you're on, that what you're doing is something that they're doing, maybe in a different context, but you're facing similar challenges. And there is this sort of camaraderie, right, that you build that way. And you are definitely one of those people for me. Like I said, we're very different people, but I see in you a lot of things that I see in myself, of being willing to stand for what you believe in, right? Regardless of what other people think is right or want you to believe. And also the ongoing sort of evolution of learning to trust yourself and to take your own intuition and your own cues as the authority, as opposed to other people's approval or an outside source of authority. And so, you know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this conversation. It's been so, it's actually exceeded my expectations. I didn't know, because we've never really had we've never really talked.
Sit down chat. Yeah. This is our first official.
Yeah. 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 We've talked online and we've emailed and whatever, but yeah, this is an opportunity for us to really go back and forth. And to me, I'm just delighted. I'm delighted to get to know you. I'm delighted to see that you're doing things that are crazy and wonderful and that you're committed to it, because that makes me feel like it's okay. Yeah, it is okay. And so thank you. And thank you for the work that you're doing. Because at the end of the day, I think what you are doing is attempting to put into the world things that are centered around humans and helping them live better lives with one another.
No, I want to thank you too, because your posts have given me so much courage. You know, the creativity that you've seen in my work, I would say, is probably directly inspired by the courage that I see you having in expressing yourself online. Like, it's contagious, right? To reference Brené Brown in her Braving the Wilderness, it's like when you share that art, it whispers you are not alone. So we're quietly whispering to each other, like, I see you too. You're not alone. And I think the word that we feel is the crazy. Like, we just feel absolutely crazy, because in the microcosm of your own little world, you know, you, I, or whoever is listening, it can feel really alienating. You can feel literally like you're not speaking the same language. But when you're sharing online, when you're sharing out there, when you're turning emotion into art, emotion into story, which is the emotion, the chaos that we see out there in the digital space, is that sort of unchanneled, unworked with emotion. We're seeing like that raw, like primordial reactivity. But the work of what you do, what I do, what essentially I think are healers in our art, is taking that emotion and making it make sense, and you know, disarming it, not making it so reactive and nuclear. The piece I'm writing on about the Satanic Verses being the Pandora's box on Islamic feminism, if I had written that piece 5 years ago, it would have been a completely different piece. It would have been aggressive and combative. But the person who's writing it today, shaped by experiences, shaped by friendship, shaped by, you know, life, shaped by motherhood, shaped by the pandemic, is someone who can take a really radical conversation, but diffuse it and make it palatable.
Well, Shireen, thanks for coming on. I hope you'll come back another time. I can't wait to read your book. When is it coming out?
Oh, as soon as I finish it. I have to finish it first. But I am looking for a publisher. I have 3 chapters and the proposal and the intro ready to go. So if anyone knows of agents or a publisher or any sort of connections there, I would be very, very grateful.
Wonderful. Well, I'm going to put your information in the show notes, so the listening audience may find you and contact you and follow you if they so desire. And why wouldn't they?
Thank you, Amanda.